CIT.
Yeah, that's good. Thanks. Okay, so
I'm going to talk a minute about this project thing. I did go through your sheets of preferences yesterday, and so I sorted the group into six-ish, maybe seven project groups. And most of you got something you preferred. There were a couple of you that had interests that were just sort of disjoint from everybody else. And so in the end, you sort of went where I had to put you low-level things. My guess is if you dig into anything here, you'll find it fairly interesting, so I wouldn't worry too much about that. But most of you got something that was in your top-level preference. Or close to it. So I will try to actually fill out a spreadsheet or put it on Blackboard or something, send you an email so you know what your group is and you'll know who the members of your group are. The next step really is for you guys to meet and chat about this topic and think about what it is you might want to do and maybe do a little bit of research and think about it a bit. So then what I would like you to do is, as a group, meet with me, and I will give you some feedback about what you might be thinking to do in terms of your presentation, things to watch out for, maybe some references and ideas and things like that that you may find helpful for that particular topic. Things that you really need to watch out for in terms of trying to present that topic, because either I've screwed it up or I've seen other people screw it up, so I can tell you don't do this or something like that. So I'll give you whatever input I can at that point. And so just sort of a heads up about this. So the idea is to take this topic, decide what piece of it you actually want to do. These are very broad. I had to put particle accelerators and detectors into one group because I had sort of two groups that were interested in one or the other, but they're very similar in terms of a lot of things. So I just put that in one group. But there's no way in 20 minutes that you can actually cover that. So what you need to do is, as a group, think about what pieces of it you might want to pull out and actually do, and do a little research and see if you think that works. And so almost on all the topics, you're going to have to really select a subset of what it is you want to put across, because they're very broad. So I'm not actually asking that you give a complete overview on particle accelerators and detectors if that's your topic. Okay? It is very fine, even if you narrowed it down to one particular type of accelerator, one particular type of detector, or something like that, that's just fine. So better to have it narrower so you actually have something to say and you can understand and you can put something across rather than too broad. The other thing I want you to consider as you begin to think about this is the way in which the grading is going to work is that there'll be a number of criteria that that you as a class will have that you can use to judge each of the presentations by, in a sense. And those criteria are things like, did you find it interesting at all? Did you find it informative? Did it actually have some relevance to the class of some form? It's not going to be, did they cover everything listed in their topic, for example. It is also not going to be individual at that point. It's going to be just what you saw as a group. And it doesn't matter if one person actually did the talking and everybody else, you know, did the media or just sat by and looked pretty. That's okay. It's within the group that I ask you, was there anyone who did sort of an anomalously large amount of work or an anomalously small, maybe never showed up for a meeting type of work? as a group, you individually will sort of give me that information on each member of the group. Now, if you particularly grow to can't stand somebody in your group, you can't actually screw them this way because I'm going to look for some consistency in the group. If four members of the group say this person never showed for a meeting, then this person never showed for a meeting. Okay, but that's sort of, it's going to be a bit consensus. But I'm not going to take just one person's word for that. If you all decide to get together and do it one for all for one, and you want to protect the one person who never showed for a meeting, okay, fine. You do that. But as a group, I think that the message, what I'm trying to say is, I'm trying to do this find the plug that you aired it. What I'm trying to say is you need to think about the end product, and different people may do different things in the project. And I don't think it works very well if you have seven people in your group and each of the seven presents a slide and a half, and each of the seven produces their own slide and a half. So in the end, it looks like seven different people having talked about seven different things, and there's no coherence and there's no flow for the overall presentation. That's sort of the default thing that the usual groups of students want to do when they do this kind of thing. And I strongly encourage you not to do that. I want you to think about the end product, and the way it's being set up is, so long as you all figure out something that is the end product, you don't all have to show your face and talk to everybody to be considered having done your role on that project, okay? So that's sort of like one of the biggest wrong things I see people do. Any questions on this? You'll have a lot more questions when you actually get together with your group and you think about it. The other thing that is really, it's really hard to do, but you have to put some thought to it, is how to narrow some of the topics down appropriately. And what is the message supposed to be? And that may actually require some work a little bit more broadly on the topics before you decide which pieces of it you actually want to talk about. Okay? And you have a lot of freedom to decide what it is. I mean, it's okay to say, you know, this is our topic, and we decided to narrow it down like so. That's fine. Okay? So you have a lot of freedom to do that. Okay? All right. I know it may sound a little unwieldy and even a pain in the butt right now. In the end, I think you'll actually end up having fun with it because the topics are relatively interesting. So hopefully you'll enjoy it. Anyway, so that is the project. Okay. So we've been talking a bit about relativity, and one of the things that we talked about last time, these Lorentz transformations. So we looked at what happens if you observe an event that happens at X, Y, Z, and T from two different frames of reference, and how do you relate the observations in one frame to the observation in the other frame if they're moving at a fixed velocity with respect to each other. And you get these transformations, which, if the velocity is small and gamma is effectively equal to 1, these actually just simplify to what you would expect to see if you were just doing basic Newtonian physics, the so-called Galilean transformations, which they better do, actually. But things get very strange if the relative velocity between the frames is large, so that gamma is not actually 1. We looked at a quantity that involves both space and time. So if you transform a standard velocity in relativity, so you see something moving with some velocity vector u, and you observe that in two different frames of reference, or two different frames of reference, if you want to relate this velocity as seen in one frame of reference to that as seen in the other frame of reference, then we derive the velocity transformations, which are a space divided by a time, and you have to transform both. And so when you do that, you find relatively complicated transformations. But these actually you'll end up having to use some in spite of the fact that they're sort of ugly. There is a special direction, just as there is with the space transformations, which is the direction that is along the direction of relative motion transforms differently from those that are transverse. In the space-time transformation, the transverse dimensions in space don't change, but that's not true in the velocity transformation. If you look in the transverse velocity components, transverse to the relative direction of motion, you find, in fact, they do transform. But they transform differently from that, which is along the way. So you just have to be careful with that. These are sort of ugly. I don't have a good way of remembering them. Put them on your formula sheet and or whatever. If you have a photographic memory, good. There they are. So, they actually, it's not hard to derive them if you have Lorentz transformations sitting in front of you. So then at the end of class last time, we defined a different type of velocity. And we call it proper velocity. And it is a velocity which is defined where the time that you put down in the denominator is proper time. And what that means is that this thing basically transforms as space, which means it transforms more simply than the velocity which we just talked about, which has both the top and the bottom having to transform. So if we define this as proper velocity and we define something which is called relativistic momentum, which momentum is mv normally, so we use m eta here, which is the relativistic momentum. If you define the momentum that way, then you find that momentum conservation will hold if the fourth component of your momentum piece is defined like this, which we call relativistic energy. So what do I mean by that fourth component? In the Lorentz transformations, what you'll note is that you take the three space vectors, x, y, z, plus time. And those get all mixed up in this transformation. So in relativity, the simplest transformation you get requires a piece that has four components, not three. So we call it a four vector instead of a three vector. You're very used to three vectors, but please understand that those are just a simple version of more complex mathematical beasts. You can have things that transform differently. So in relativity, not so much in this class, we'll talk a tiny bit about this. I'm really just trying to introduce this a little bit to you. In 217, if you take that, you're going to have four vectors rammed down your throat, probably. So you'll get used to them. They're very useful things. But you'll have to learn how to do dot products with four vectors, and it is different from how it's done with three vectors and things like that. There are more complex beasts where the transformations are even worse, so these are called tensors. So vectors are really just very simple tensors, so you can have much more complicated things. The mathematics can, in principle, be arbitrarily complex, but you can use a lot of the intuition that you used with vectors in the first place. So in relativity, the simplest kind, there are things that require more complex transformations, but the simplest kind of transformations we typically see are these Lorentz transformations, and those require beasts that have four components. So whatever it is that I want to transform in relativity, I'm going to have a foursome of some sort. And when you want to do space and time, it's the three spatial dimensions plus time, and that's what gets all mixed together here. It turns out that if you want momentum conservation to hold, the fourth piece you have to have turns out to be this, and we call it relativistic energy. So if I look at how momentum and energy transform, then I write the Lorentz transformation in terms of that foursome instead of the space-time foursome. So instead of XYZ, I put in PX, PY, PZ, and instead of T, I put in this weird thing, which usually we just call in, you know, B, for example. So, and there are many, there are other things that can transform as sort of this four vector, but these are the two you run into most of the time.
Okay, any questions about relativity at this point? All right, so it's going to be a little dissatisfying in the sense that I'm sort of introducing some of this stuff and we're going to let it hang. I'm not going to give you another month of relativity stuff so that you get very warm and fuzzy on all this. There is a group that's talked about that is going to do relativity and electromagnetism, and I'll point that group to a number of things, and selectively they may drag you through a bit more of this within their presentation if they want. But they have to be a little bit careful because they don't want to make that too tough. So, okay. Not that it's particularly hard, but it takes some time to go through it, which I need to do other things with this class. It's fun stuff. But in 217, you'll do more. All right, so you may be wondering why I've wasted your time with relativity. It's cool stuff, but this is electromagnetism. So let me just give you a little feeling for that.
Imagine that we have a tube filled with positive and negative charges, or if you wish, a wire that has positive and negative charges in it. And let us suppose that the negative and positive charge densities as a function of distance are the same. Okay? Then I have a question for you. If we go outside of this wire to some point P, what is the electric field at that point? It's not a trick question. What do you think?
Yeah, ask P0.
You all okay with that? Every positive charge, you have a negative charge basically right beside it. If you were to, you know, arrange this with cylindrical symmetry, you could do Gauss's law. You can prove that the enclosed charge is zero, so you have an electric field with zero. Okay? It's not rocket science. Okay, so maybe it is a little rocket science, but it's not really rocket science. So
what that means is if I put an electric charge at point P, there is no force on it. Right? So now I want to do the same thing, except now what I would like to do is to look at the system, the same system, but we're all going to be running with a velocity v that way.
What happened? Let me back up, because I forgot an important thing. You can imagine these densities being identical. And let's imagine that you have these negative charges actually moving with a velocity u to the left. But the densities stay the same. Okay? In such a situation, if we're talking about the electric field, the answer stays the same. Right? It's not quite a static situation because things are moving, but from the electric point of view, it's a static situation. So now what I'd like to do is to look at this situation. Where we're running at velocity v to the right, okay? Now, if we're running to the right, and these are moving to the left at velocity u in the rest frame of the wire, then these things will be moving with some u prime, right? You know the velocity in one frame, you can calculate it in the other frame. All we've done is change frames of reference, so whatever was moving. In addition, these now will be moving they'll appear to be moving with a velocity v that way in our rest frame. Right? Okay, so now we are in a frame of reference and we are looking at something that is moving with respect to us at velocity u prime and something that's moving with respect to us at velocity v prime. Are these densities the same? They'll both be length contracted relative to what we would have said in the other frame, which means the densities will change. But because they're moving, because we are moving with different velocities with respect to each of them, the gamma is different. So the length contraction is different for the positive and negative. Okay? Now, is there an electric field at point P? There is. What's changed? Nothing but our point of view. And in one frame of reference, you've got no electric field there. And in another frame of reference, you've got an electric field there. Yeah.
Is it the whole thing that's moving to the left with velocity u? If it's about y, is it not length? Why is the negative charge not length contracted in the first picture?
I'm not sure I understood. Yeah, think of this as infinitely long and all the negative charges are moving, say, one way, and now we're running beside the wire.
Was that traveling at velocity u in the first picture, too?
Yeah, that was the part I left out. Sorry. I had to go back and correct that. And you can argue, you can set it up in such a way that you can argue that when this is moving, the densities are the same. Let me make that simplification, because otherwise you could argue that you have length contraction there and all of that. But let me artificially construct it. So yeah. It doesn't. The details sort of don't matter. What I'm trying to get you to realize is that you can construct something where it's very obvious that the electric field that you perceive depends on your point of view, in the same way that the space or the time you perceive depends on your point of view. So
this is, I don't know that this was the one bothering Einstein, but his paper is entitled On the Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies. And there are lots of things in electromagnetism that can bother you if you don't actually understand relativity. So I hope that this example shows you that that to really get at the root of electromagnetism, you're going to have to make it relativistically correct, and that can be more complicated. Turns out I can't give you a Lorentz transformation that's as a four-vector-ish Lorentz transformation for the electric field. It's more complex than that. But what we find is that this clearly shows that we're leaving something out, that something else has to come into play. So one of the things that means we have to have is we have to invoke yet a different type of force, which is called magnetism. And you'll see that if we want to know, for example, let's see, if we think about this for a moment, I'm going to say a few things and we're going to come back to it, maybe it dies or so, or whatever, so it makes sense right now. But we are moving faster with respect to this velocity. So you can think of this as being contracted more, which means you have a larger negative density here, okay? So that would tell us that we would expect to see an electric field that wants to attract a positive charge this way. So we'll have an electric field going in, okay? We're about to start talking about magnetism. One of the things we're going to learn is if you have a current, it will create a magnetic field in the space around it, actually in concentric circles. And so if I use the rules we use for magnetism, it will create the negative charge density moving that way will look like positive going that way. So it'll create a magnetic field that turns out to go into the board. If we have a positive charge at that point, we can figure out the effect of the magnetic field on a moving positive charge. It will be upward, as strange as that may seem. And that would be in the direction of the electric field that we just get using straight relativity. So there's, I guess I'm going a little bit backwards here, because people understood magnetism before they knew anything about relativity. But you can use relativity to sort of think about what's going on with the magnetism as well. And then to make it relativistically correct, which maybe the group at the end of the term will talk about or not, but certainly in 217 you will, it turns out that you do have a fairly complicated transformation. It involves a tensor instead of just four vectors for all the electric and magnetic field components, and it turns out that they do Lorentz transform, and they get all mixed up depending on their directions and how fast you're moving and everything. So what you perceive as some mix of electric and magnetic fields in your point of view can change and look quite different if you're looking at it from some other point of view. So it's sort of neat stuff. Okay, so something's missing from our picture, and now I want to go back and sort of just start talking about magnetism from more of a historical point of view. Okay. Any thoughts on this? Yeah.
Where is the current here?
If we're moving this way, let's ignore these because this one is more Lorentz contracted, so it's going to dominate. So if we're moving that way, it's going to look as if all these negative charges are flowing this way very fast, but that would be equivalent to a positive current that's flowing to the right. So if a positive current is flowing to the right, it's going to give me a magnetic field at point P, which is into the board, and then V cross B gives you a force that's up. So we'll get to all that, even at the end of this class. Okay, so anyway, let's do magnetism. right, so people are aware of magnetism, or became aware of magnetism at, I would say the awareness is, it's less, it hits you less dramatically than electrostatics does in the real world. Because electrostatics gives you lightning and things. And magnetism is a little simpler, right? You can get little magnetic rocks and they'll align with the field of the Earth, or you can take two of them and they'll sort of wiggle each other. So, but it is an effect that people understood. And after a while, they found some materials that actually can exhibit magnetism in a bit of a stronger way. So we would call them iron magnets, for example. So iron can have magnetism. And magnetism, let us just say for now that there exists such a thing, which is called the magnetic field. And you can think of it in the same sort of way in which we thought about the electric field, in that the magnetic field is something which will exert a magnetic force on a moving charged particle if it's at that point in space. In the same sense that electric field is something in space that exerts a force on an electric field, on a charged particle if it's sitting in space. So we're going to define this to have a symbol B. It's going to be a vector. The magnetic field will have a direction, so it's a vector field just like the electric field. And we will measure it. The MKS unit is in Tesla. The CGS unit is Gauss. And the basic equation that you need to think about the magnetic field is something that encompasses both the electric and magnetic field, and we call it the Lorentz force law. So if you have a charge in a region that may have electric and magnetic fields, there's a force on that charge which is equal to Q times E, which you already know about, plus Q V cross B. This is the cross product. Remember anything about the cross product from mechanics? It's a vector multiplication, just like the dot product is, except for it has a couple of differences. The dot product, remember, is a vector multiplication of the magnitudes of two vectors, where you're multiplying one vector by that component of the other vector that is projected along the first one. And what you end up with is a number. It's a scalar. Okay? The cross product is different. The cross product, again, is the multiplication of two vectors, but now you take the magnitude of one and you multiply it by that component of the other, which is at right angles to the first. And in this case, we also give it a vector, a direction. So it turns out to be a vector. So it's very different from the dot product in a couple of ways. And you're going to get really good at the cross product. Or else. So it's a little bit strange, though, this whole cross product. And the direction is very odd. So I need to remind you a little bit about the cross product. So if I have two vectors, say an A and a B, and you now have to be careful using the little x symbol as a simple times, because in this course from now on, that's not just a simple times, it's an actual vector operation. Okay? So if you take two vectors and you do the cross product, you end up with a vector, and the magnitude of A cross B is equal to the magnitude of A times the magnitude of B times the sine of the angle between them. And you may recall this piece, for example, would be the magnitude of A times the sine of theta, and this piece would be, at least the magnitude of it, would be the magnitude of A times cosine of theta. So in the dot product A dot B, this is magnitude of A times magnitude of B times the cosine of the angle, which is what projects out this piece. If you put in the sine, you're projecting out the magnitude of this piece. Okay, so that's the thing that's giving you the right angle piece. So that's the magnitude. The direction is given by what we call the right-hand rule. First of all, okay, raise your right hand. That would be this one, okay? If I see you on an exam doing the right-hand rule with this other hand, I'm going to quietly snicker. And then I will mark all of your problems on the exam. So if you need to, it is quite okay to put a nice R on your right hand for class. It's just good. So let's all make sure that we agree this is the right hand. There are little tricks you can use, such as if you're dealing with negative charges, you can make things work if you use the left hand. Boy, that's asking for trouble. I would suggest you always use the right hand, but in doing so, we're using the same positive charge, positive current sort of conventions and everything. So anyway. So the right hand rule, you want to get really good at it. The way in which it works, you see these two vectors, you think of the plane containing the two vectors, and you think of the angle that is the small angle between them. There are two angles, right? There is this angle, and there is this angle. Think of the small one, and we call that the opening angle between the two vectors. Yes, you can argue that is an opening angle too, but that's not the one we're talking about. We're talking about the smaller one. In the plane that contains the two vectors, there's an order, A cross B. That is not the same as B cross A. Okay? A cross B. One way to do this is to orient your hand so that it is perpendicular to that plane. You orient the right hand. Okay? You put your fingers in the direction of the first current, the first vector, and you curl them in the direction of the small angle opening between them, and your thumb will point in the direction of the vector that represents the cross product. So in this case, A cross B is a vector that goes into the board. Okay? There are different ways to think about it. I don't care how you think about it so long as you're right 100% of the time. Sometimes you will see people that will be doing this business. You can do this business. You can say, okay, I'm going to put this finger along the first vector. This finger represents the second one, and my thumb goes into the board. That's okay. Just you've got to make sure you know what you're doing and you don't hold it the wrong way. So if you learn that way, that's fine. The way I think about it is like so. I want you, we'll do things to practice on it, but you want to get really good at that. I'm going to tell you a story that probably shouldn't leave the room, but it will help you remember this. Back when I was in general physics, I sat in the back with the soccer players, who were my party buddies, and the physicist, the engineer who taught my physics class, wasn't a particularly good engineer or physicist, I'm afraid to say. So class was largely a waste of time. It was a small college, so we'd go anyway. But I spent my time admiring Patty Eller, who was a voluptuous, lovely lady who sat in the front seat. And Patty is quite a brilliant girl. She's got her PhD in organic chemistry now, and et cetera. But Patty always never questioned her intelligence, but she was always a little bit like this, like, well, so this is just sort of her way. And so she was confused about the cross product, and my professor was talking through and said, okay, all right, one way to think about this is imagine that you have a screw that is going into the board, okay? And you can take a screwdriver, and if you put the screwdriver in, how do you twist it in order to get the screw to go into the board? You would, if the slot were like this, you would take it and you would do that, which rotates you from A into B. And she looked puzzled, and he looked at her and said, Patty, you've screwed before, right? And we just thought that was hysterical, of course. And it took a minute for each of them to sort of realize how inappropriate that was. And I laugh about it to this day, and it's ridiculous, and I don't mean to be incorrect, because, as I say, I have great respect for both of them, but it was really funny. And at any rate, but if you get confused about orientations here, you can think about Patty Eller, and you can make sure you get your directions right. That was a high point of my general physics. I still laugh about that, actually. It was pretty funny. Maybe you had to be there. At any rate, so right-hand rule is how you usually think about these things. It's a bit confusing in the sense that what we just said here, if I have a charge that's moving with a velocity V through a magnetic field B, the force that's on it is given by the direction of this rock, this cross product, which means it's at right angles to both of those things. So that's going to be a little bit weird. To impress upon you how weird it seems, what I have here, which I hope you can see, maybe I should turn down the lights a little bit. This is what is known as a cathode ray tube. So what we have is a beam of electrons being projected out, hitting a phosphorescent screen. So back in the old days, this is what televisions were, actually. You put a different sort of screen, and depending on the energy of the electron, you can excite different colors. Or you can just make it so it's just bright and not bright, sort of bright. And then all you do is you take this beam and you scan it very quickly, and you turn it on and off, and that gives you the basic dot pattern that turns into a TV. Things are a little different now, so you don't see these so much. But this is a regular magnet. I have a beam of charged particles moving velocity that way, and look at this. This magnet is sending a magnetic field that effectively goes out that way. Okay, it comes back like a dipole pattern. But if I go in toward it, so I have a magnetic field going that way, I have a beam moving that way, look what happens. Stupid beam moves at right angles. Isn't that great? I turn it, so I reverse the field, I'm reversing the direction. So this didn't come down from a mountain carved in stone. That equation comes from people sitting around doing this crap. Whoa! Look at that! I do this and it goes in. That's amazing. So cool. Okay. So it's an empirical fact that the charged particle will move at right angles to the magnetic field. So I hope you're believers in that now. The cross product, depending on how you did your mechanics, the cross product is something that isn't as easy to calculate as a dot product. But the way to do it is using the determinant. And you can use the determinant by writing the components I, J, and K here. And you put AX, BX, C, no, AX, AY, AZ here, and BX, BY, BZ here. And the way in which you evaluate this is you take this I and you put it down and you multiply it by this times that minus this times that. So you multiply it by AX times BY minus AY BX. Then you put a minus sign and you do the J hat. And for J hat, you take this and you multiply it by AX. No, I want a different color. You multiply the components that are not underneath the one that. What's wrong?
You wrote pi and you wrote AX, BY, which is below.
I just wanted to see if you were paying attention. Make sure you get that right on the test. I will have no sympathy. Well, I'll have a lot of sympathy, but that won't do any good. That's right. Thank you, young man, for paying attention and correcting us. Yes, so you start out with this piece, and you multiply this times that minus this times that. Then you go to this piece, but you have to pull in a minus sign, and it becomes this times that one minus this one times that one. And then you do the third one, comes in again with a positive sign, and it's this times that minus this times that. So there is a basic pattern which you want to get right. So for J, I want AYBZ. You're not asleep. Why? Yes, I want AY. Wow. Okay. AYBZ minus AZBY. Okay. For J, have a minus sign AXBZ minus AZ. BX, and then K is going to be AX BY minus AY BX. All right. Yay. That was a struggle. It is my sincere wish that you will have an easier time of it than that. Not generally so difficult. This I find doesn't have a lot of intuition to it, but this turns out to be a way to do it, and it gives you the IJK components of this vector, which is over octagons. So you do need to know how to do this and get good at it. Hopefully you retain that longer than I did. Okay, so the magnetic field does things at right angles. So if I have a wire, I have a big magnetic field, I have the field going between the poles of this big magnet. Right here, so the field is effectively going like so. I have a wire. If I put a current through the wire, it's as if I have a moving charge. So Q, B cross B is going to give me something which should be at right angles to V, which will be one way or the other here, and B. So it ought to either push it down or pick it up. Make sure this is switched to two different things. So I have to make sure I get it actually the right way. So when I send current through the wire, you watch the wire, it jumps at right angles. So it's sort of the same thing we had over there with the cathode tube, but quite a different example. Okay. So you can play with currents and magnetic fields to your heart's content. So let's look at this a little bit. Imagine that I have a uniform magnetic field. All of a sudden, we're going to go three-dimensional now, which some people find they're uncomfortable with compared to the two-dimensional thing, especially for graphics. So what that means is that vectors which are coming out of the board will look like that, because you can think of the point of the arrow of the vector coming at your eye. And vectors that go into the board are going to now be crosses, and you can think of that as the feathers of the arrow going into the board. It's a little context dependent because we just used the X to represent the cross product. So if you see the X between two vectors, you can safely assume that means cross product. If you see it in a figure in some big extended region with lots of other X's, you can safely assume that means a vector field going in. Okay? So let us suppose that we have a magnetic field that is coming out at you. If the dots are distributed roughly evenly, it's telling you that it's a uniform magnetic field, or a uniform field. In this case, I will label it B, so we know that it's a magnetic field. And if we have a particle moving with a velocity V in this direction, then V cross B is going to be in what direction? I want to see everybody get their hands out, the right hand, the one with the R on it. Okay? Put your fingers along V. You want to rotate your fingers of your right hand in the plane that contains the two vectors where the thing is small, so it's a little awkward in this case. So you're along V, curl it into B, so it's going to be a force down. So what that means is, as this particle is going in the magnetic field, there's a force at right angles to it, so it's going to respond to that, it's going to begin to move down. As it does, the velocity is going to change direction. So if the velocity is changing direction, the velocity is going to be at right angles to the motion. What is the direction of the force on that particle at that point? V goes down, V is up. It's at right angles again sort of like so. So what you have is a force that is constant in magnitude, that is always at right angles to this thing, and that's a recipe for circular motion. So if you have this thing going in a magnetic field, you'll end up with the particle executing circular motion, if it's all in two dimensions, with a force toward the center. Boy, that's not going very well. The force toward the center, whose magnitude is given by qv cross v. And the force toward the center is mv squared over r, just because you're on a circle, and the magnitude of it is equal to qv times v, because it's qv cross v for the magnetic field. So you'll end up with a circle of radius mv over qv. Or momentum over charge times the field. So this turns out to be really a nice, very powerful thing. If you're worrying about accelerators, if you're worrying about diagnostic material, diagnostic equipment, for example, suppose you have a beam of particles that might have different masses. If you can create a beam of them that has the same momentum, and you put them through a uniform magnetic field, those different masses are going to be split into different circles of different radii. You can then put in detectors and actually detect the particles of different radii and determine what their masses are. So this is a very useful thing. When you're building accelerators, the way to accelerate a particle is to put an electric field on it. Okay? So one way to accelerate particles would be to put devices which can create electric fields all pointing in the same direction. And if you do that, you can send them in a line called LINAC for linear accelerator. And it works. But it's expensive because these pieces, it turns out, that you use to accelerate, to put the electric fields on, are fairly expensive to produce. So a way to get around that is to put one of these things in and then take the particles and bend them in a magnetic, uniform magnetic field in a circle and have them come back around. And every time they come through, you kick them. And so it's a different type of accelerator. It's the same sort of thing, but you effectively circle them around so that, one, you have less tunneling to do. Instead of having something that's 1,000 pieces long, you just send them around the same circle 1,000 times. And you have to time it, because now they're going faster and faster, so you have to adjust the timing so you kick them the correct way each time. But as simple as it seems, there's a lot of power in this ridiculous equation. In fact, the early type of accelerators, there used to be one here. They have this little building now. There's this ugly little building right by Optics, a little low thing. And there used to be a pink pig. Is it still there?
Yes.
Yeah, so sort of where the pig is. There used to be a little accelerator here. I mean, I don't know if you realize, but back in like the 1950s, Rochester was like a center for particle physics. There was a famous guy here named Marshak. And the biggest international high-energy physics conference the first N of them were actually held here. Marshak organized them. So that was a big deal. It turned out in those days, you weren't anybody in particle physics if you didn't like have your own accelerator. Okay, so the accelerators were small enough that universities could actually build them and fund them. So one of the early types of accelerators is called the cyclotron. And we had a cyclotron here. And the cyclotron is made up of magnets. And these magnets, so you can think of these so-called Ds as a magnet where I've separated them this way, and it's in between them there's a magnetic field. And we're looking at it from above. So there's a magnetic field going into the board that's uniform in the regions of these big magnets. So if you look at it from the side, you'd see something that looks like this with a gap in between. And now I'm going to send a beam of particles starting here, sort of in. So imagine that I have positive charge here and negative charge here. And so I start out with a beam of positive charges here. They'll be accelerated across the gap because I have a field across, electric field across the gap. So they'll be accelerated like so. They then enter a region of uniform magnetic field. So they'll curve in a circle and come back around. And now, in the time that they come around, I flip the charges on these two things. So in the between here, I'm flipping the charge like so. So when the beam of particles, when the pulse of particles comes back around over here, I now have this positive and that negative. So it will get accelerated like that. Then it comes around. It's now going faster, so it goes in a circle of a bigger radius. And by the time it comes back, I flip the charge again. So it now comes this way. Then it's going in a bigger radius because it's going faster, bigger momentum, accelerates like so, etc. And so then the thing basically eventually sort of comes out the side, but now you've accelerated it so you can blast something, have a good time. So that device is called a cyclotron, and it makes use of this. If you're into chemistry at all, there's a device in chemistry that they call a mass spectrometer, where you basically can take a sample and vaporize it, you can hit it, and then you have a little electric field that will accelerate charged fragments. And it may seem sort of weird, but if I have a material of a certain type of molecule and I hit it with a flame or something to vaporize it, it will typically break apart in characteristic ways. And so if I have a molecule of a certain type, it will end up giving me fragments with certain masses, typically. And you can use that information to try to figure out what the structure is. But what you can do is, once you've created these charged particles, you accelerate them a little bit again. You put them in a circular magnetic, in a uniform magnetic field, and you put a detector over here. And basically, if you know how much you accelerated them, then you can look at the different radii they use. You detect them over here, and you can figure out effectively what the masses are. And you can determine what fraction broke into what mass of a certain type by the intensity of the peaks in a detector over here, by the number of them. So it's called a mass spectrometer, and it just makes use of this same stuff. Thank you. One of the things that you may notice, the particle's going that way with some velocity. The force of the magnetic field on it is at right angles to it. What does that tell you about magnetic fields accelerating particles? The accelerating because they are changing the direction of the velocity. So you can use magnetic fields to control direction, but the force of the magnetic field is always at right angles to the movement of the particle. So the work is always zero. Okay? So if you're going to speed a particle up, you have to give it kinetic energy or whatever. That you have to do with electric fields. The magnetic field you can only use to turn it or analyze it or something like that. So magnetic fields do no work on charged particles. So very often, if you have an individual charged particle, then the Lorentz force laws I just laid out for you is sort of what you want to use. Very often, we put our little beams of charged particles actually in wires because it's more convenient that way. So imagine we have a wire which has a current running in it. And remember that a current, even if there are electrons moving, we define the positive direction of the current to be the direction of the positive charge would flow. So if we have a current flowing such a way, and we have a magnetic field into the board in this region, then what you have are charges, positive charges, flowing along I, curl it into B, which is going in the board. There will be a force on this wire, which is going up. You saw a demo of it a minute ago. The force on the wire is equal to the charge of the individual charges that are flowing times the velocity of these individual charges. This would actually be the drift velocity that you see in the wire cross B times the number of charges per unit volume times the cross-sectional area times the length of the wire. The current itself is equal to the number of charges that you have per unit volume times the charge that you have on each of the charges times the drift velocity times the area. So we can rewrite the Lorentz law force piece as the force on the wire is equal to the length of the wire that you're considering times I cross B, or you can think of it as I L cross B. So it's a little bit weird because we haven't really thought of current as being a vector. Now you do want to sort of think of it that way. So what we have is a length in which there is a current. And there is a direction involved because it's going to be along the length in the direction that the current is flowing. So you have to assign that direction somewhere. So you could say it's the current and it's going a scalar length, or you could say it's sort of a magnitude current and you have this length in such and such a direction. So you can sort, you will sometimes see it written one way or the other. But this is a form that you will find in practice, you will use quite a bit. This you will also use quite a bit. But there's really nothing in this form that isn't Lorentz force law, and it's the same thing. But it's in a more of a suitable form for a wire. Okay, so if I had time, what I'd like to do now are to do some examples using Lorentz force law on wires and charges. I'm going to come back and do that next time. I want to go ahead and give you just one more sort of conceptual thing before we run out of time. So if you recall in electrostatics, we have Coulomb's law. And so if we have a charge Q and we consider something at point P, which is at a distance given by a vector r away, then we say that there is an electric field, which is K Q over r squared times r hat, and that there is a force on the particle which is equal to q times the electric field. And if we have a distribution, then we consider point P out here. We think of a little piece in here which is at a vector r away from that point P. And we consider the differential electric field at point P equal to K times dQ over this R minus R prime squared times R minus R prime unit vector, where this dQ is at some vector R prime, if you want to think of it that way. So we've done all this before. So I just want to remind you of that. In magnetism, we actually have analogous stuff going on. We talk about something which is called magnetostatics. And one of the neat things about it is what we've looked at so far is that if I have a region with a magnetic field, we say that it can exert a force on a charged particle. It turns out that if I have a moving particle with a charge, it will also create a magnetic field. So just so you're a believer, here I have a wire which is set up such that it cuts up through a piece of plastic. And I'm going to put a current on the wire, which means I just have a beam of moving charges. And I have iron filings, which will act like little magnets if there is a magnetic field. They should orient a little bit. So right now, I'm just going to scatter them here, and they should sort of end up looking random on there. And now I'm going to create a current going in this wire. And so you'll be looking at the wire is going like this. So the current's going to go like that or like this. And you're going to be looking at what happens in this plane. What I hope you're beginning to see is that these things are beginning to form concentric circles. If I have a compass, which I didn't ask for, unfortunately, if I have a compass and I put it here, when I turn the current on, you'll see it flip from being dominated by the magnetic field of Earth to being dominated by the magnetic field of this wire. And it will orient itself so that it's at right angles to the direction of the current. So, as it turns out, currents will create magnetic fields. And I'm out of time. I have to stop here. We will come back to this. Sorry.